Aloha, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Noe Tanigawa. A measure in the state legislature is seeking to make home ownership possible for Hawaii residents who've been priced out of the market. It aims to build condos in Honolulu's urban core that would sell for about $300,000. As HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us, the plan draws inspiration from one of our Asia-Pacific neighbors, Singapore.
More than 80% of Singapore's population lives in a public housing unit. That works out to be around 4.5 million people. The island nation's expansive public housing program is run by a government agency called the Housing Development Board, or HDB.
The housing program began actually after the Second World War.
That's Ho Chi Tim, a Singaporean historian and a graduate of UH Manoa. He says as Singapore began decolonizing, the national government viewed the creation of public housing as an essential service.
The Housing Development Board itself began in 1960. It was a reaction to a fast increasing population in Singapore. It was increasing faster than homes were being built. So there were plenty of dangers or at that point in time, because homes were mostly like what we call attap houses, or houses built out of very flammable materials like wood, natural materials. So there were a few fires, and almost every other year during the 50s, there would be a big fire and tens of thousands of people would be homeless. So when the HDB first came up, it was meant to quickly house all these people who were affected or made homeless by natural disasters like fires.
Over the following decades, the HDB began building entire communities, anchored by amenities like food markets and public transportation.
So in each estate or each town, there'll be your apartment block, there'll be markets, there'll be infrastructure, there'll be accessible transport. And for time, those estates would also have, industries or light industries built nearby. So people could go to work without traveling too far. So like self-contained towns.
These days, HBD flats are squarely targeted at the middle class. Developments often include gardens and community playgrounds for children. In the world's third most densely populated country, a two-bedroom apartment on the resale market costs less than $300,000 in all listed neighborhoods. New HBD flats are sold under 99-year leases with no extension for a resale. That's the model one Hawaii lawmaker is seeking to replicate.
I think it's important that if we're going to try to solve a problem, that we go to successful examples of where that problem has been solved.
That's Stanley Chang. He represents the area from Diamond Head to Hawaii Kai in the state Senate. His proposal is called Affordable Locally Owned Homes for All, or Aloha Homes. Chang chose the Singapore program as his model after learning that the island country is able to house a population 5 times greater than Oahu's in an area about half the size.
My aim is not just to make marginal improvements, but actually to try to solve the housing shortage. And so we're proposing a strategy that has worked in Singapore to provide abundant, affordable housing by developing state-owned lands near rail stations with high-density units that would then be sold at cost with no taxpayer subsidy to Hawaii residents who own no other real property and who will be owner-occupants.
Those units would be sold on 99-year leases. Owners would not be able to rent out the property. The units could be passed down to children, but ownership would revert to the state at the end of the lease period. 75% of any profits made by reselling a unit would go to state tax authorities. Under Chang's plan, no recurring public funding would be required. He estimates that the state could recoup the construction costs by selling Aloha homes for around $300,000 per unit. But the proposal has generated some skepticism in the community.
This bill does not address the root causes of why we lack housing and why housing costs so much.
Keili'i Akina is the president and CEO of the Grassroot Institute, a conservative-leaning local think tank. He says a better option would be to open up more land for development.
Now, everybody thinks land is absolutely scarce in Hawaii, which is simply not the case. You know, studies show that we only develop on 5% of the land. That means 95% of all land mass is either preserved for preservation purposes, the environment and so forth, or for agriculture. Now, what would happen if you developed on just 1% more? You went from 5% to 6%. you'd increase the available land by 20%, and do the math there in terms of supply and demand. You would have a reason to bring the actual cost of housing down. And the real problem is that the government, through a maze of regulatory laws and rules, creates an artificial scarcity. And that's what makes it unaffordable to have housing in Hawaii.
Akina also has concerns about the 99-year lease period. He says that returning properties to the state, rather than allowing them to stay in the family longer, prevents Hawaii residents from accumulating generational wealth. But some business advocates have embraced the idea. The Hawaii Chamber of Commerce supported the Aloha Homes bill at the state capitol. Sherry Menor McNamara is the president and CEO of the chamber.
I think, again, we can all agree that the lack of housing impacts our working families and small businesses that employ them. And housing affordability creates pressure to increase wages. And because of that, increasing the supply of housing should alleviate some of that affordability pressure.
The construction of units for purchase marks a change from recent affordable housing policy, which has focused more on affordable rentals. But Connie Mitchell with the Institute for Human Services says that isn't necessarily a bad thing.
In the social service sector, we've been really focusing on having enough rentals for folks who are making below 50% of area median income. But the fact is that when you create more housing for others in the whole spectrum, you then have people moving up into other housing and you make room for more people on the lower end. The other thing is that the folks that would be able to afford them are people that we really need to stay in Hawaii, and we've been having trouble because many of them have been leaving to live on the continent, and it's really important that people be able to purchase a home, to put roots down in the community, and be more a part of the community long term. You know, we cannot keep losing people to the mainland.
The Aloha Homes proposal comes with some uncertainties. There isn't a specific plan for enforcing the occupancy requirement, although Senator Chang has some ideas about using biometric scanners to verify who is living in a unit. It's also unclear whether any private developers would be willing to take on the projects with the slim profit margins needed to keep the units affordable. Senator Chang believes developers will be able to achieve sufficient profits through scale. He wants to build at least 6,000 new units every year. It's estimated that Hawaii will need up to 65,000 new housing units by 2025. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
Mahalo, Ryan. We'll have links to more information on the Aloha Homes proposal, including a video walkthrough of a public housing flat in Singapore. It'll be posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation. I'm Noe Tanigawa. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Many waves of immigrants have come to Hawaii to work the plantations and to do the jobs that those who had come before either couldn't or wouldn't do. Usually, we talk about the population of Chinese, Japanese, Portuguese, German, Filipino, Puerto Rican, African, and Korean emigres who made their way to Hawaii's shores. But there's one group that isn't among the list we just gave you. This group was lured to Hawaii in the early 1900s. Reasons included personal freedom, a chance to escape the despotism of their homeland and make their fortunes, as well as, of course, an opportunity to live in a pleasant climate. For our backyard quiz today, name this ethnic group and, for extra credit, what work they came here to do and where many of them wound up. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University's performing arts students in their annual concert, Moonlight Serenade, this Saturday at Lutheran Church of Honolulu. hpu.edu/arts@hpu.
Foodies everywhere know her name now, but when Netflix asked her to appear on their highly rated Chef's Table series, documenting outstanding chefs around the globe, Korean nun Jung Kwon said no. She saw no point in it. However, once convinced it would be an opportunity to share both her food and Korean Buddhism, she agreed. Her 2017 Netflix episode was kind of a bombshell with its radically different take on food. You could say it's still being digested in elite culinary circles. Jung Kwon Sunim, the honorific for a Buddhist monk or nun, was invited to Honolulu recently by the Paul S. Honda Foundation. She offered a cooking demonstration to KCC culinary students and hosted gatherings for people interested in her work. I was honored to meet her in Kalihi, at the farm she'd chosen for our interview. Solid greens are the backdrop for Ho'olu Aina, a 100-acre organic farm and community resource provided by Kokua Kalihi Valley to help link people, food, and aina. Here, with rows of lettuce, beans, squash, zucchini, kale, papaya, taro, spinach, virtually singing a chorus all around us, Jung Kwon, the now famous temple chef, looks really at home. She's traveling with Yoon-hee Kim, a tea and culinary educator, and her translator, who's worked with the nun/chef for many years. I asked about Jung Kwon's response to this food, growing.
Individual human beings, based on their backgrounds and the influences that they have been given in their lives, differ in so many ways. All the various produce are different and have their own individual characteristics. And even when you look at, for example, the kale that are here, the same type of produce grown in the same lot, the relationship it has towards the direct sunlight and how close it is to the earth and whether they are close together or separated by itself will differ, and ultimately whether some grow very small or others flourish and grow much bigger and so on. Even in the same lot, you have those that are on the ground that have been seeded by wind and rain and so forth, and it is growing. And then you have those that have been planted by the human effort. They too are different. And so to truly understand, have a sense and feel for these items, one must give one's energy by working over the period of time enough of oneself in working the land, caring for it, to truly understand the characteristics of each of these different plants that are here and have a true feel for them, which you cannot get just by studying it.
Ooh, bad news, my urban compadres. But maybe there's an easy way, right?
She spoke earlier about the energies. So you've got the earth spirit, the sky spirit, and so forth, and that even in this papaya tree, you have energy that runs through it. And so when you're talking about being in sync with the tides of the moon and such, you have to work the land to be able to truly understand, the leaves are good for consumption. In that case, it should be the roots. And in that case, it should be the fruits that should be consumed. To be able to know at once and to differentiate how and what should be appreciated and when. That's where the human knowledge and experience comes in, to work in sync with nature, understanding how the cycles work.
I'm trying to understand how do you preserve or even enhance the energy that is already in food?
During temple stay, when she's talking about ingredients, she will talk about, you now have all these ingredients, be it a bamboo shoot or shiitake mushroom or dandelion leaves or whatever it may be. For somebody who creates, it's not just about enjoying and eating to fill our bodies, but to nourish in a holistic perspective. From that perspective, the person who's looking at the food ingredients, at once you must respect all that is coming from the foods itself. How do you do that? You need to know where these items came from. Truly, where did they come from? If you yourself are not growing them and harvesting them, what is its origin? What is its essence? And knowing that, recognizing, is this the right time of the year to pluck and to create? Because at the end, whether you are a movement-oriented living beings, be it humans with two legs or animals on four legs where you can physically move from one location to another, you also have living beings that are immovable, plants and such. They are fully living beings. So we as human beings, in effect, cut their life in order to consume, to nourish us, so that you must do so with reverence and respect. The way we give back is recognizing what they are and being able to, with respect, highlight that ingredient as best as it can, which will then give its best energy to us. The energy as the chef or anyone, whether you are cooking for yourself, your family, your friends, or in a restaurant, it's the combination of recognizing, respecting the ingredients, putting your whole energy into it, combining with the energy of the ingredients. You are then giving it energy, and it will then give energy to all that consumes it, both body and spirit. We're not just taking.
There's the freeway noise, I know, but it's also as if the plants are humming. Casey, our kind and generous guide at Ho'o'ulu Aina, filled our arms with a giant wanbak, daikon, and tea leaves, which Jeonghwan would use to wrap rice for a dish in the coming days. Dressed in a simple light gray tunic and loose gray pants, nicely pressed, the rather tiny nun surveyed the vegetation, practically screaming all around us. You could almost hear their eager reports about what it's like living there in Kalihi, drinking in the rain, swelling up with the sunshine, which was now emerging from behind a cloud. Jeonghwan bent down near a papaya tree.
Is this the turmeric that's showing? It looks like turmeric, but the color. Again, it's all about being one, unity, the cycles of regeneration, birth, death, rebirth, and so on and so forth, so that when you look at the turmeric, the self, the field, the ahu, they can't ever be in separation unto themselves. They have to be all thought of in a holistic manner, because only when it is all one, birth, the death, rebirth, only when that is all as a whole, are we at one.
일단은 그 나고 죽는 생사를 초월해서 나고 죽음을 자유자재로 하는 게 붓다예요. 그래서 우리가 그렇게 하기 위해서 음식을 통해서 자기적인 정신 에너지와 육체적인 에너지로서 meditation을 하는 겁니다.
So you asked earlier, how does that energy of the food come into us, and how do we give back our energy and so forth? And part of that key there is meditation. Food originally was thought of as medicine. Food is a vehicle through which we walk towards our own self-discovery path towards enlightenment. If that is the case, the mechanism to help facilitate that, especially in the philosophy of Buddhism, is through contiguous meditation. So, meditate, a daily practice. She always speaks of, it doesn't have to be long, it doesn't have to be formal, but daily practice of meditation helps us to be able to understand and consume the foods as a way of nourishing both our body, the physical form, and our spirit and our soul.
그래야만 나를 열어놔야만 자연이 자연이 보이고
시대해.
자연이 보이고 거기에
Only when one is open, can you in fact absorb the energies from all various sources. All various sources, and be able to create something that is uniquely your own.
It's okay.
She's asking, is that okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Korean nun Jong Kwon Sunim says, I'm a meditator, not a professional chef. She says temple food should prepare you for meditation, not excite the senses. It doesn't have to be fancy or even tasty. I hope you enjoyed this brief introduction to her approach. You'll be able to find links to more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Natasha Lyonne talks about co-creating and starring in the Netflix series Russian Doll, in which her character keeps dying and coming back to life and doesn't understand why. Lyonne nearly died of drug-related problems in 2005, which led to her recovery. In 2014, she was nominated for an Emmy for her role in Orange is the New Black. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll circle back with the organizers of Purple Prize to see how the teams are developing. Purple Prize has just completed the connection phase and are now entering the building phase. We'll find out what the teams have learned so far. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
You're probably listening in the car right now. Well, how's the traffic out there today? There's nothing we can do but own our traffic here in Honolulu. We got it. We deal with it. But if it's any consolation, in today's reality check, Civil Beat's Marcel Honoré has found there are reasons we have the flow or non-flow that we do. Marcel?
Hey, Noe. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, you've been doing some research here. What did you find?
Well, I was really interested in just some of the stranger, more awkward intersections that have taken shape around town. And I flagged some of the key ones that I think, at least in my article today,
yeah.
that intersection over by Kauai Hau Plaza, the intersection over by the Humane Society where wildlife, King Street, and of course, kind of the Frankenstein intersection that is Kapi'olani and Date Street and
Kamoku. Little six-way?
Yeah, just a you know, quaint little six-way monster intersection over there. So, you know, I did some research on this just to kind of see how these took shape, and it was just kind of interesting. I geeked out over some maps that are available in the UH library.
Love those
old
maps.
Historical survey maps. And the state land survey, I should say. They also have a good collection of maps. Mm. And it really just, it shows how these intersections really started to take form in a lot of cases about 100 years ago. And they've just, that footprint has been with us as the car capacity has increased and trends and standards have changed. These areas really took shape, you know, before we saw the vast amount of vehicle miles traveled that we see today. Mm. And also before the H1 freeway took shape. And I was talking to John Noucci the other day. He is the deputy at the Department of Transportation Services, and he pointed out how the way a lot of these streets and intersections were mapped out made a lot more sense before we kind of built this giant kind of superstructure to push as many cars as possible through and across mm-hmm. the island. And it might have made sense at the time in some ways, but it really did kind of interrupt a lot of the more localized neighborhood traffic flows.
Ah, so we're kind of living with the evolution of a city.
Right. It's the legacy of a lot of other planning decisions that took place in decades past.
Well, I thought it was so interesting that you pointed out there are things we don't notice that could have been the reasons for why things are that way. For example, underground water.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a drainage canal, the Pololo Stream, and the way that's situated. You know, you can't just right. You can't just build around the water system. that adds another layer of complexity.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to send in their nominations for most hairy intersections and so on. You've really started something here, Marcel.
Yep, that's, it's funny. I kind of put out the call for it prior to publishing this article, and now that it's actually out and there's a companion piece with some of the ones that Civil Beat readers nominated, mm-hmm. Now that it's out, people are really starting to write in, so it's kind of cool.
I hear the tom-toms going. Well, a pair of tourists, my cousins, could not for the life of them figure out how to get on an on-ramp to the H1 eastbound in town, and they're from L.A.
Yeah, and I'm from L.A., and I share their sympathy. I share that sentiment, for sure.
Well, look, you got to know what you're doing to get around in Honolulu, and I guess it's going to stay that way.
It's an art form.
Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Noe.
All right. Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Today, featuring reporter Marcel Honoré. It was fun. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. I always love seeing Neil Milner around the station here, and he's in today on The Conversation. Retired professor of political science there at UH Manoa, he's back for the long view, this time on how we disagree. Americans have an illustrious history of disagreeing, right, Neil? And maybe we've worried about it since the beginning, how to handle it.
Well, you made it sound like I kind of drop in here for a free cup of coffee, but I appreciate the compliment. Well, yes, this is an interesting question that can be defined this way. Have we moved into something that the authors of this study call lethal partisanship? And the answer is maybe. But let me just do a quick history lesson so
Please.
We understand. The founding fathers were always worried about partisanship and how that would disrupt the country. And to make a long story short, even without political parties, the United States has a history of some serious partisanship that turned to violence. And the Civil War, where the equivalent of today's population of 7 million people were killed, is an example. What happens in about the mid-20th century is that we no longer have that kind of lethality showing up. And so what you have is people begin to think about partisanship in kinder and gentler terms, social identity. That's the way when I was studying graduate school. That is, you clearly were attached to one party or another, and that clearly was important for long periods of time, whether you called yourself a Democrat or Republican. But it was benign, right? I mean, you didn't outgroup the other party. What's begun to happen in the last 20 years, at least for sure, is that there is something that's not so benign anymore. And we outgroup the opposition. We don't want our kids to marry someone from another party. We tend to see the opponents not just as different, but as morally bereft. And so these folks who did the study say, we want to look more closely to see if there is a movement back to a more lethal partisanship. That is polarization moving us in that direction? And that's the context for the study.
Mm-hmm.
So what they find is, yeah, kind of. And the way they do it is that they have a series. This is a national survey, a couple of national surveys, and they look at three different categories of things that they ask people about. Moral disengagement, which is, how much do you see the other side as immoral, as inhuman in many ways? Do you depersonalize them? Do you see them as evil? About 40% of the sample did, and Republicans and Democrats are about the same. The next stage is Schadenfreude, which is a fancy pants term for feeling pleasure in the pain of others you oppose. It drops there. You've got about 15% of the people who feel that way. And then finally, out-and-out advocacy, out-and-out justification of violence when you say it's sometimes necessary.
Lethal part of the
that's,
ship.
Well, it's all, well, it's a gradation toward lethal. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's the real lethal part. You can think about it being lethal when you begin to in-group and out-group and depersonalize, but you're right. That's the real lethal part. So figure about 15% of the people take that position about violence. Equal number of the Democrats and Republicans.
Well, that's a pretty big percentage.
That's the interesting question. Is it as much as or as few as? They say it's as much as. They say, look, if you multiply 15, you know, if you take 15% of the population, that's a lot of people. Even they don't say that guarantees violence from these people. But they do say we're pretty sure on the basis of other questions that a good a majority of that 15% says we're not just talking; we really mean it. So that's the movement toward a lethal partisanship.
Question for you:
yeah.
The way you laid it out, okay, is it sort of post-World War II that we had some shared ideas about what civility was like?
Yes. Post-World War II, you had a lot of interesting things and important things going on. You had consensus over the war. You had an increased kind of prosperity. And remember, the movement toward equality reached its climax in the early 70s, where there really was, you know, if you look at surveys now, income surveys now, there's inequality is not getting better and even gets worse. And so you had this. You also had norms of bipartisanship. You had the sorting of Democrats and Republicans weren't nearly as clear as it is now. If you do surveys now, virtually everyone who says they're conservative says they're Republicans. Virtually everyone who says they're liberals said they're Democrats. Didn't used to be that way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. Well, one reason is that you had all of the racist politicians in the South who were Democratic and were conservative on other issues. But generally, overall in the population, there was much more overlap, and there wasn't there wasn't this outgrouping. You didn't think about your Republican neighbor down the street if you were a Democrat as someone you wouldn't want your son or daughter to spend time with. Those are fairly new developments. And that's really, some of that stuff didn't really start showing up until, I don't know, as I say, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You can't tell from this. But that's clearly a difference where political party now is not only the most important signifier of how you live and how you think about all kinds of other things, even more so than race in lots of ways now. But it's also now moved into this direction of moral, this kind of depersonalization. That's been showing up for a long time. Mm-hmm. We're essentially, and if you think about how your friends or my friends talk about the opponents, this comes up all the time. These people can't be trusted. They have to be out. And it used to be that the opponent, if you did surveys after a presidential election, you know, a little while later, the losing party people would have a fairly high level of trust of the one who won. Not anymore. And the Trump case is a very good example of that. Democrats have nothing good to say about them, and for the most part, Republicans have a lot of good. It's about as polar opposite as you could get. So that doesn't guarantee violence by any means, but you see these things all coming together to make the whole partisanship lean more in the direction of a potential for violence.
You're describing different kinds of Americans, sort of. I mean, because if we think back to post-World War II, Americans were thought of by the rest of the world as generally idealistic. We've been so generous, and we've been proud of being generous.
Well, that's right, except you always have to remember that this was always done pretty much either at the expense of African Americans or ignoring them entirely. That is, if you look at our social welfare system from the Depression on, a lot of the stuff came to be with bargains made with conservative senators that essentially made it very difficult for African Americans to benefit from this. So you're right. We certainly had a reputation for being cohesiveness, for sure, and being fairly idealistic, but we don't want to forget that it's easier to be that way when you eliminate one of the things that would have made us much different.
Wait a minute. So as we are becoming more diverse and accepting that we are more diverse, that's the very moment at which we're more polarized.
Well, I think that's right. And part of the polarization, as we know, is about people who are more afraid of diversity. But I think this will take us down a different road. You have to look at the history of racism with African Americans a little bit different than you look at how people react to their communities getting more diverse. This is deeper than that. This involves highly educated people, very active in the political process, and of both political parties. So who knows? You can't. I'm certainly not predicting violence, because that requires all kinds of, mm-hmm. of situations and so on. But you certainly have things that move us in the direction of justifying it that we didn't really have much of before.
Thank you so much. Fascinating. And the NPR report on the polarities in Portland yesterday just set us up for this. Thank you so much, Neil.
Look at it. You're welcome. Take care. Retired
professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Thank you, Neil Milner.
It's important to know what's going on, but keeping up can be a lot, especially with those news alerts blowing up your phone, leaving you stressed and confused. When you need some shelter, a safe haven from the noise, you turn to public radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is your space for respectful, thoughtful dialogue and reporting that breaks down big ideas. Bring yourself future moments of peace. Here's how.
Become a sustaining member on the HPR app or hawaiipublicradio.org.
Today, we looked at the long line of immigrants who came to Hawaii to meet the increased demand for labor, largely driven by the expansion of the sugar market. The litany of plantation workers runs from Chinese, Japanese, Portuguese, German, Filipino, Puerto Rican, African, and Korean. And there's one group not among them, and that's what we asked you to name today. Starting in 1909, Siberian Russians made their way to Hawaii. The almost 1,800 of them wanted to be free of poverty and control under the Tsar. But the transition to Hawaii didn't go as well as planned. The language barrier, disease epidemics, differences in temperament, and actually working in the hot, humid climate took their toll. Eventually, the immigrants refused to work and created a camp at Iwilei. They lived in mat-covered huts with no sanitary facilities. Over time, many found jobs as stevedores and mill workers. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha. I'm Luke Cooperhouse, the Executive Director from the Rutgers University Food Innovation Center. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Swing down the car.
sounds so good. Feeling better already, right? Well, recently we got word about some art activity in Hilo Town involving illustrator John Dawson. You've seen his work for sure with the U.S. Post Office, the National Geographic, the Audubon Society, and many other places, or at least up at the Kilauea Visitors Center, where he did all the forest and wildlife murals there. Well, for the last month or so, John Dawson's been painting away. He even drafted his wife, Catherine, to help painting the wall of a laundromat in Hilo. I've seen pictures of this thing. It's super hometown pride, so I just had to give John a call and ask about, you know, what he had in mind there.
Well, I thought it should be Hilo. And my wife and I, Kathy, we like to go down and sit at, like, Coconut Island and watch the birds and watch the kids jump off the tower there and watch the turtles. We love it down there. So I thought, well, that'll be my base. So it's not exactly the scene, but it does on the left, there's the tower, and I have kids jumping off it. Then I have about 10 different birds. I have frigate birds. And I have a storm over the ocean in the background. Kaleas, I have two Kaleas and about three turnstones and tattler. In the background, I have some spinner dolphins going. I have a monk seal. I have a honu. In the foreground, a lava rocks, and then I have some nopaka on the left.
Oh, that nopaka really looks good.
It makes a good balance on the bottom left, kind of, so yeah.
Have you been, you know, getting comments from people?
Yeah, they love it. And people are always thumbs up and yelling, yay, that's great. Yeah, they're watching it in progress, you know. Mm-hmm. The water at first, the ocean was just flat, and now we're putting in waves. And I have a canoe surfing in the background. And you know, so one of the guys said, oh, you don't have any whales. So I walked to the horizon and put some, you know, spray coming up from...
Do they want you to put Vernas in there and maybe Kens?
No, I don't know about that.
Well, gee, did you ever think that in, you know, your later years you'd turn into a graffiti tagger?
No, I never thought I'd do this. It's a learning experience and learning how to paint so that it looks good from a distance. It's fun, and people seem to be really enjoying it. So that's one of the great things about it, is the reactions from all the people that look at it.
Well, John just loves it, painting down there in the laundromat. And you know how laundry is such a huge part of our lives? I thought, why not give John's friend Michael Shoemaker a call over there in Pipi'ikeo? He's the owner of the laundromat, the one with the bright idea to get it painted inside. He knows I'm trying to contact him, and he's trying to leave the island on a trip, but just thought, oh, hey, let's try.
This is Michael. Hello?
Michael, hi, it's Noe Tanigawa.
Hi, Noe. I'm sorry you had trouble getting a hold of me.
Oh, not at all. Jeez, it was just brilliant to I guess, come up with this idea.
John's is not the first. I'm an artist, and I own the laundromat. And so when I built it, it had all these walls, and I thought, hey, we ought to put some art up. And John Mydock, his art is just terrific. It's airbrush, and people just love what he did. But John's thing is just so totally different. And I thought, hey, you know, if John was willing, it would be a great thing if he would put a new one up.
Wow. And that worked. Can you tell me a little bit about your laundromat? What hours are you open?
We are open. Always open. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
No
kidding. We close. We close on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day, and that is it.
Well, people have to wash their clothes. This is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's just an unbelievably popular place. We are almost overrun. I did my best to make it comfortable and really almost luxurious. I mean, the place has Corian countertops throughout. It has a very strong air conditioning system, so you get hit with a blast of cool air when you walk in. It has huge flat-screen TVs, and then it's got a really nice area for the kids to hang out with their own TV, and they can play there while mom or dad does the laundry.
Oh, my gosh. Spoil me, yeah. Michael. I don't even want to do laundry at home like that.
Well, we get everybody because we have a lot of customers that have washer and dryer at home, but it's way better for them to come to us. So we run the gamut, and it's been just a wonderful thing for me. I've been here 40 years, but, you know, Holly Guy opens a business downtown. You know, you never know what the response might be. And, oh, people treat me like gold. They just love me because, you know, I've done something nice for them. And it's just a place of total aloha. All my employees are so fantastic, and we have a good time there. And so it just rubs off on everybody.
That is so, the name of your laundromat now.
Downtown Laundry Express, and the express is because it only takes an hour. You can run one load of laundry, put it in the dryer, be finished, and out in an hour.
Did you really get a lot of business when the volcano was erupting and people were kind of displaced last year?
Oh, yes. That was, you know, inevitable. It's the perfect business for Hilo because when it's wet, people need to do laundry.
Oh, yeah. And,
but every so often, we have a drought, you know, when it doesn't rain. And we get this whole different crowd because there's so many people on catchment, and they can't do laundry when it's dry. So we've got to kind of bracket it.
Well, you're telling us so much about how Hilo works.
Yeah, it's, I just am totally in love with downtown Hilo. My wife and I have worked in downtown Hilo for so long, and it's home for us.
Well, thanks for making a nice place to be.
Yeah, thank
yep.
you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Yes, you do. Bye.
Talking there with Michael Shoemaker, proprietor of Downtown Laundry Express in Hilo, where John Dawson's painting a mural of Hilo'one. Sand Hilo, the area we know as Hilo Town. By the way, before we go, there's one more thing tomorrow night. Six Oahu choirs and choral groups, that's a lot of vocal muscle, are uniting behind Michael Fomai's epic orchestral work, Raise Hawaiki, a tribute to the Hokulea. You might have caught the mini version when Hokulea returned from its worldwide voyage. Now, this is the fully fleshed out animal. I know you singers have had this music ringing through your brains for weeks now, so props to Oahu Choral Society, University of Hawaii at Manoa Choirs, Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus, go guys, the elite Kawaiʻola Ona Puʻukani Leo, Kapiʻolani Community College Choir, University of Hawaii West Oahu Choir, all joining with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. Check that out. That's about it for today. And up tomorrow, it's a call-in show. We talk in the wake of the college admission bribery scandal. Are you a student or the parent of a student applying for college? We want to hear what you've experienced working to get into that school of your choice. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Noe Tanigawa. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.